Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and often interrupt our daily lives. So let's tap into the pulse of young folks. This edition of 411 Teen talks common sense. The common sense teen consists of teens with diverse political affiliations, all in the IB program at Rickards High School. The panel seeks to analyze and evaluate current national, state, and local politics. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me at the roundtable, I welcome Mamie Oldham. Mamie is in 11th grade, and her thing is political science, international affairs, and music.
Hi, I'm Mamie.
Glad to have you. And Jackson Burks. Jackson will be taking over 411 Teen, and he'll be the contact for the IB program. He is into politics, theology, and hunting, turkey particularly.
Yes, ma'am. Happy to be here.
I'm always glad to have you, okay? On April 24th, 2018, the Leon County Board rejected applications for the Classical and Plato charter schools. Charter schools were originally established to concentrate on low-performing students who were struggling to read. Charter schools are considered public schools, and they utilize taxpayer money, yet they do not have to meet the same standards that your public schools do. Several points were emphasized in the denial of the applications. Schools should provide the same educations that we're proposing. The question of segregating the district arose. And Leon County Schools has been identified as one of the most segregated systems in the state. As a Leon County public school student, what is your position on charter schools?
Well, I think we've talked about this before on the show, and we have. And I think my overall opinion is that the focus of taxpayers' dollars should not be focused on charter schools, but more so into the already established and schools that have been integrated into the system, like our school, Rickards High School, more funds being channeled into them, more support, more programs, as opposed to funding these charter schools, which can oftentimes attribute to the segregation that has plagued our county so often.
Well, you're right. We have talked about it, but this is one of those questions that come up, and I got emails wanting to hear from you, so that's why we're readdressing it again. They wanted to hear from students who were in the public school system, and since this has happened, since we talked about it, I'm just letting you know that's why we're dealing with it. Mamie, do you feel the same way? I mean, what do you think? How do we address these concerns?
Yeah, I actually do agree with Jackson, so I can't really provide much controversial opinions here, but I definitely think that the existing public schools, there's already so much controversy surrounding the allocation of funds towards certain schools in certain parts of the city. And I think something that hit close to home recently for me was the was when an issue came up about whether Hartsfield Elementary School would be turned into a charter school. And I know a lot of people in the community, and I went to Hartsfield for 2 years, did not want Hartsfield to become a charter school and instead wanted better resources being channeled into the already existing school instead of uprooting sort of the tradition that had been built in that community around that school.
I wonder if charter schools are considered public schools, then why do they have separate standards? And that's something I'd like to have you respond. They do have separate – they don't have the same standards that you have. And do you think that is something that should be addressed? And what message are we sending if we are, you know, granting these charter schools, you know, money from public schools, yet we're saying, okay, you don't have to meet these standards. You have to do – X, Y, and Z, and it's okay for us. So we're separating and creating an unfair
environment,
system.
Yeah. I think it's a big problem. And in Leon County, there's a lot of – there's new schools that are being planned on built and restructuring. So I'm hoping that will help the issue with segregation in our county. And I think that – the direction the county's taking with the schools is a good one. But I also think that any – and they did reject I forget where it is, the charter school recently. And I think that's a good move for them, is to continue focusing on our public schools as opposed to handing out taxpayers' dollars to schools that are less regulated, which really I just don't think is acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, in the whole spirit of standards is to ensure that the places where taxpayer money is being allocated is, you know, regulated to the extent that it can be in something so like complex as a school. And so I think that the privacy, the sort of wall of privacy that is built by allowing charter schools and allowing different administrations to govern over those schools, I think that does just create a natural issue when it's still being funded by the same money that could also go to public schools.
And my question also is, are we duplicating education? I mean, for example, the two charter schools that were petitioning, you know, to get their application approved, one was classical and Plato. I mean, don't we deal with these issues as in our schools? I mean, don't we deal with class? I mean, so –
yeah, I see that.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, there's some duplicity in what's being covered and what they're using to justify their opening of their charter schools. And I think that just – I mean, it's I think it's a good thing that the board rejected their proposal. And, yeah, I do think it creates a duplicity. And especially if it's not standardized, you can lead to a lot of duplicity depending on how that charter school goes. So I definitely agree with you, Doctor.
And even the requirements of the teachers are – I mean, they are – totally out of, you know.
It can be all types of crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're nodding your head. Okay. All right. That's cool. Another issue. We have a lot of them. On Wednesday, May 2nd, middle school students at Mumford Middle School walked out in support of Stand for Second. This walkout was organized actually by a high school student from New Mexico. As a rebuttal to the whole massive gun control walkout back in March, where thousands of students across the nation left class for a universal walkout, so to speak, and it lasted 17 minutes, 1 minute for each student that was killed. The Stand for Second supporters believe in the right of all Americans to support the Second Amendment and state that banning guns is not the answer. Now, I know we've also talked about gun control, but this puts a little different twist on it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we are addressing that again today. And it's another one that we received an email and asked the students, where do they stand on this? So as you see it, and we look at this, whether it's gun control, Second Amendment, what do you see are the issues when we talk about, I guess, this mass murder?
Yes.
And I mean, that's what it is.
It is.
It's nothing. I'm not being, you know, melodramatic. I mean, that's just what it is.
Well, I mean, I think I love to see the students working on both sides of this issue and kind of working, because it's a very complicated issue. And being too one-sided on it can lead to a lot of issues. And it is – the Second Amendment is in the Constitution, and it's been reaffirmed through the Supreme Court in several different scenarios. So, I mean, personally, it's a very tricky issue on banning guns because you have a lot of lack of knowledge on what guns to ban. And that's a big part of that walkout. So I think banning guns is – not so much the issue right now in the United States to what's available. Mm-hmm. It's to whom it's available and how to attain it. Because, I mean, in the United States, the process to get one is very easy, but what you come out with at the end of it is not that different from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the big issue, and I love that the students walked out in support of this.
Okay.
Yeah, so for sure, for the Democratic free speech side of it, I really like that we're seeing all of the students on both sides of the aisle be super active in protesting what they believe. And I think that it says a lot that they're sort of mirroring each other. I think it's just a really good way that all of these students have sort of come together, especially in the school environment. They didn't have to go anywhere else, be a part of any other political group. You know, they could go to a place where they spend every single one of their days and still find a way to be politically active. And then so on the gun control side of it, personally, I agree that saying we should ban guns is one oversimplifying a very complex issue. And even if you are proposing that we ban guns, just phrasing it in that way is still oversimplifying what you are actually proposing.
You read my little note of what I was talking, because I was just going to say that whole thing about banning, because I don't know that they're really talking about – see, if they're really talking about banning guns as opposed to controlling the availability of, as you mentioned, certain types of guns. But when you see it in the headline, it's banning guns. So what does that say? Banning guns says, oh, we're going to take your guns away.
Yeah.
Is it really about taking the guns away? Because that's not what they're trying to do. You know, I don't think that students want to take guns away. I think they – I don't know. You tell me. Maybe they want to – because it's crazy to think that you're going to take – like you hunt.
Yeah, yes, ma'am. I do. And I have a firearm of my own, and my family has a lot of firearms. So
exactly.
it hits close to home for me. I think I might disagree, though. I think there's a lot of students on the side of the aisle who marched out or in response and to push for gun control. I think a lot of them would say we need to ban guns and take away certain guns. I mean, in California, they've already started implementing long-standing laws to take away guns from unstable people. And that's certainly something that I would not be opposed to. But it's like you said, it's the control of guns, the banning of guns. I don't personally believe there are any firearms on the market right now that are a particular issue. I mean, you have semi-automatic firearms and you have reasonable calibers. You have to go through an extensive process of licenses to get to the large – to own a 50 caliber rifle, which is the large caliber legally allowed in the United States. So I think – the issue and part of the reason these students have marched out is because there's a misunderstanding on both sides. Is you have one side who is calling for banning of guns and taking away of some types of guns, and you have one side who owns those guns, and they are not going to have that. I mean, I own a semi-automatic firearm, and it's been in my family for 100 years, and you're not taking that from me, and it's done nothing wrong, and I'm a legal firearm owner. That's the argument.
And the question also is it the gun or is it the individual? That's something else that throws it up. You know, like you were saying, and it's done nothing wrong. You've tuned in to 411 Teen, and we are talking with Common Sense. We're looking at a number of current national, state, and local issues. It's time to take a brief break. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm talking with students from Rickards High School. We're talking common sense. Did you have anything else you wanted to say? I had to interrupt you.
Okay, So I don't have as personal of a connection or, you know, pride over any firearms because I don't own any and my family doesn't. However, I still, I definitely don't agree that banning guns, if we want to put the argument that way, is a probable or would be a successful solution at all. I definitely think that things like increased background checks and more extreme vetting when it comes to allowing people to buy guns in the first place, especially – see, I don't have like expertise on like the stats of these guns. But, you know, the more powerful guns, I think that's definitely – the step that I would personally push for in terms of gun control. And I think that, like Jackson said, I do think that there actually are a lot of the students that participate in the walkout, I think they do actually want like very extreme gun control measures. And I think they do want them very quickly. However, I don't personally agree with that. And I think it also,
it's not going to happen.
And I think it also causes an issue, and this is just sort of a general thing that happens in politics, but when you have those more radical ideas, it sort of overshadows the more moderate proposals. So I think that a lot of conservatives might look at the movement and say, oh, they're just trying to ban our guns. And again, it's overlooking the possibly relatively small comparatively to the people who want to ban guns. But I wouldn't say so. I would say actually the majority are more moderate and instead just want to talk about ways we could compromise and improve the existing regulations so that people can still have their Second Amendment rights.
Right. Okay. In Philadelphia, two black men were arrested at Starbucks after they did not order food or drinks. They were waiting to meet a third person to join them for a business meeting. Starbucks announced that they would close all its stores May 29th so that its employees could go through racial bias training. Starbucks also said that they would award free tuition at Arizona State University as part of their settlement, and then the other part of the settlement was undisclosed, the financial component of it. The city of Philadelphia reached an agreement with Nelson and Robinson, and those are the two guys. Each will get a symbolic dollar from the city, and then the city will spend $200,000 to start a program for young entrepreneurs. What does this say to you? What does this say about racial profiling? Many say that it doesn't exist, but obviously here's a situation where, you know, they weren't doing anything but just sitting and waiting. And anyhow.
I think that regardless of people's idea or personal opinions on whether or not Starbucks and the city of Philadelphia should be, you know, sort of enforcing the sort of, I guess you could say, reparations that they are. I think it is significant objectively that these large entities are recognizing that it was a wrongful practice in the first place. And I personally think that, you know, Starbucks legally has the right to, you know, do what they want.
Oh, yeah.
And then I also think that the city of Philadelphia, I don't think that any of the things that they're doing are particularly radical or going against either side of the aisle. I think that it's sort of just recognizing an issue that made itself tangible in this situation and trying to find ways to fix it in action and not just in conversation.
Okay.
Well, what I think a lot of it comes down to is PR for Starbucks.
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Come on.
with the people who buy from Starbucks, the majority of their demographics.
No, and hate to interrupt you. It's about money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they don't want to lose any revenue based on this issue.
Right,
So they closed all their shops for a certain amount of time to give some training. Which I'm personally very skeptical of.
Yes.
Whether
I'm glad
it caused any change.
Because how is that? I mean, how is one day training going to change? But
and
go on.
I think what I think was more significant is what the city of Philadelphia did is that they weren't necessarily involved in this issue. They didn't have anything hurting them or necessarily. And I think – I mean I used to live in Philadelphia I'm a Philadelphia fan. And them reaching out and forming this program and doing this, I think, was really, really great. It says a lot about the racial profiling in this country that this would happen. But I also recognize that there are a lot of factors in a social situation like this that sometimes can get a bit hazy. And I don't know the details. I wasn't there on this day or what was going on. And it doesn't appear as anything was done that would have provoked this type of response of the police. So I'm inclined to believe that this was just based down on racial profiling. But it gets very sticky. It does.
I totally agree with you. Not that it matters, but I agree with you. And how do you feel? What do you say? What does it say to you about racial profiling?
I like Jackson said. I think it's really difficult to sort of objectively evaluate situations where racial profiling is in question, and a large part of it does come down to the social context, the social cues that aren't detectable by anyone other than a witness or somebody who is involved in the situation. And
you all are good. And you know how to skirt this issue when the real issue, I mean, you know, because we could always identify what are the variables, you know, what happened, what were the conditions. You weren't there. I wasn't there. None of us were there. And I'm not saying one way or the other. But it does send a statement. It does make a statement about racial profiling.
Yes. And I definitely agree that racial profiling is an issue. I was just just sort of, you know, saying that.
You were just covering yourself. I know.
Yeah.
I mean, but I do think I can wade through. See, you know, I have a tendency to wade through all that rhetoric, okay?
Yeah.
And then we got to get down to the real deal. And I mean, again, I say this, you know, I'm not critical of either one of you, but recognizing, no, you weren't there. I mean, I know you don't know. None of us know. I don't know what was happening either, you know. But it does send a message, and it says something about racial profiling.
That's yes. And I think it says something in general, one, about human nature and a lot of the issue, the huge, big, complex issues of racism around the world and in the U.S. boils down to just historically the way humans have developed spatially, culturally, and those are that the product of that has been racism. And in the past, a lot of it has been very tangible. And now with racial profiling, that's the issue, is that it's not necessarily as tangible. Like I said, unless, you know, you're there and stuff.
And then if you're there, you can ask three or four different people. And
they'll all have different responses.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
So basically, it's just really, I think, because we have switched towards a more systematic version of racism and one that affects people socially still to an extreme, it's more difficult just to, in general, interpret the standing of all of it and the situations and the people that are involved. But I do think it's a huge issue. And I think, like I said, it's sort of just a product of the way that racism in America has evolved over time. And I think this is right now one of the major products that we're facing.
As young folks today out there in the world, what kind of suggestions may you offer or do you maybe even think might help in addressing this? Okay, I mean, as far as Starbucks is concerned, because we know one day of whatever they're going to do is not really going to change anything, okay? And how one feels racially, I mean, the truth of the matter is I don't care whether you like me or not, okay? I'm really serious. Yeah. But as far as opportunities, and I need to be treated fairly.
Yes.
So I'm not saying, ooh, well, let's kumbaya and all of us, you know, hold hands. It's not about that, okay? I mean, it's beyond that. Mm-hmm. So that's what I want. Do you have suggestions? As young folks, you're in touch with how people feel. You're in touch with both perspective. I mean, what kind of inroads would you suggest that might really make a difference? Maybe just even the kind of people maybe that you hire.
Well,
I don't know, you know.
I think where the race issue in the United States, what it comes down to a lot and why it is so complicated is the socioeconomic standards that a lot of African Americans have been forced into.
And it's not just African Americans.
Oh, that's the minorities in general.
Minorities, okay. Yeah. I mean, if you look different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a big part of the problem because as someone who is not African American, I mean, you can make the argument that the statistics are there, that more African Americans commit crimes, so racially profiling is not racially based, it's just based on statistics. And that's where it gets really sticky, and I'm not necessarily proposing that's my point of view. But what I think it comes down to is a broader of ending the socioeconomic divides in this country. And, I mean, educating and increasing the economic value of the African American in our society is if you educate them and you support them and they can become and fulfill the middle class, then this will be less of an issue. There won't be as many people saying, oh, well, I mean, they commit more crimes. I mean, we have to be careful and racially profile. That argument will end when that happens.
The only thing I would interject there that you're saying, Jackson, is it's not about just African Americans, and I don't want this to be just African American because we're seeing it happen with Hispanics. I mean, we're seeing it happen with Muslim.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's not just African Americans. So that would be a comment, and I could go on, but any other comments?
Yeah, so I definitely think that a socioeconomic approach and sort of attacking what many would consider to be one of the roots of the issue of racism as a whole is definitely a good approach, and it is probably the healthiest that you'll find. But I also think that one of the issues that's sort of arisen with that in the past is the issue of gentrification or a sort of general sentiment that some of the reforms that have been proposed to, you know, desegregate the school system, to improve lower socioeconomic standing neighborhoods that are predominantly African American or Latino. And a lot of those have been interpreted as gentrification or trying to pull away different groups from their cultures and their backgrounds. And so I think that that's really the only issue that comes up with that. And so I think once sort of in the U.S. and around the world, we sort of learn to navigate the social issues that come with more standardized economic reform, you know, zoning reforms, things like that, that are sort of set in stone, they still carry that social connotation. And so I think once we learn to navigate that, then those reforms will actually be successful.
In other words, whatever zip code you live in, okay? I mean, that's what it's about, okay? This will touch home. We're talking about the zoos and confined animals. This is a question I received this morning. The first American zoo was in Philadelphia in 1874. So that's what I'm thinking of, okay? However, you know, zoos go way back. When archaeologists start looking, they discovered evidence of zoos belonging to pharaohs, evidence of zoos belonging to Chinese emperors. A couple years ago, and I know you I have to remember this, a three-year-old fell in one of the enclaves for the gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo. And the zoo killed the gorilla, okay, a 17-year-old gorilla. The incident shocked a lot of Americans and rekindled that whole long-standing debate about the ethics of zoos and aquariums and keeping animals in captivity. Wanted to get your opinions. One of the listeners asked me, what is your position on zoos? Are zoos a safe haven for poaching and habitat loss, or are they something that just man enjoys the entertainment and stars are willing to participate in? I mean, where do you sit?
So I personally, not the biggest fan of zoos. I feel like there are much better forms of recreation, but I still do think I know that a lot of people do enjoy going. And it's sort of also just become a cultural tradition, I guess, you know, like going to a day at the zoo with the family, things like that. It's sort of become ingrained. And so that's why I don't think that, you know, proposing that like all zoos be shut down or anything is the is a probable response. But I do think that it's pretty undeniable that a lot of the zoos and aquariums do have some inhumane practices. And again, it varies zoo by zoo or franchise by franchise. But I think that's the key to it, is that like a lot of it has been franchised and sort of made into this commercial thing. And because of that, people's complaints is that the priority is no longer the animals, which it supposedly began as, and instead just became more focused on the money and the tourism and those sort of things. And I think that – I don't know, like, the specific regulations on zoos or anything like that, but I think that maybe part of it might just boil down to enforcing regulations more strictly. But I also don't know if those systems are inherently flawed in the way they were created in the first place either. So,
do you think that possibly we are forcing animals to live in cramped cages just, you know, from birth – to death, just about, because we have some that are born there just for people to be amused and distracted for a few hours?
No, I'd kind of disagree a little bit. I think that the prime priority is still conservation of these species. And if honestly, I think in most scenarios, even only in the most seclusive, are the priorities of the animals not taken first. And if they are not properly provided for, that is partially the problem that the zoo is not making enough money, because the zoo is there to make money to care for the animals.
Right, exactly.
And I think with a lot of habitat loss and a lot of lobbies in the United States, it's the best way to conserve just the survival of these species is to capture them and put them in an environment that is unfortunate, but in most scenarios, survival. And I'd also like to make a comment on the event 3 years ago or such. Harambe was that gorilla's
name.
Yeah,
that's right.
The reason that the gorilla was shot is because often if you tranquilize the animal, because that was the complaint of people were like, why didn't you tranquilize it?
Yeah, I didn't go into
when
this.
When a gorilla is tranquilized, it often thrashes and acts very aggressively, and that could have killed the child easily with a gorilla that size.
Right.
So that's the reason that animal was shot in particular.
Okay. All right. As we've got a couple minutes. As we look at things, evaluate different things, let's look at Frankenstein, okay? And I guess you go, now, why in the world is she talking about Frankenstein? But I'll set it up and then we'll probably take a break. The story of Frankenstein, the scientist who created him and the creature, continues to follow and to serve a cautionary tale for today's world. Today's students, today you will have the choice of using genetic engineering or artificial intelligence. Scientists are discovering all different types of ways of altering human and animal DNA, but we have to wrestle with the consequences. My question is, do you believe that scientists and technology innovators, so to speak, hold themselves morally accountable for the consequences of their work? This is going to be an ongoing issue as we progress technologically as far as DNA and genetic testing.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a very tricky road is what it is. And I think this being these technologies being available worldwide in places where the United States can't regulate them is a very scary thing, especially in respect to eugenics and things like that. I mean, the Holocaust on a genetic scale could have been many times worse. And it's scary to think about. So I think it's a very scary line, and I would always err on the side of caution. Let's not do it, as opposed to create something that we might not be able to regulate.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I have students from Rickard's IB program. I have Jackson Burks and Mamie Odom. So we were talking about science and advanced technology, artificial insemination. Insemination, that's part of it. Artificial intelligence, I mean, that's mm-hmm. it is part
yeah,
of it.
Component.
You
yeah.
know, that's a big component, and that's what I was getting ready to go into. But I wanted to have you respond to, do you think that, what do you think? What is the position that scientists and technology innovators hold?
So in regards to the perspective of a lot of scientists and people who are, you know, sort of directing these advances in our technology, I think that the morals of it, the reason that they become so cloudy is because from an academic standpoint, from a research standpoint, a lot of it is about pushing the previous bounds of scientific creation or technological innovation. And so when it becomes about that, it's sort of just about seeing how far you can go. But if you step back from a moral standpoint and you put that in a different lens, sometimes seeing how far you can go is going too far. And I think that's the general issue, and it's been historically an issue. And I don't know if there's any way for it to be solved. I think that it'll sort of just be a back and forth of maybe creating something and then realizing it was a mistake. But like you said, as we progress, and we've been progressing fairly rapidly, I think as the technology and these opportunities for either great success or great failure become more intense and more concentrated, the threats also become more heightened.
Do you think we can teach scientific creativity and responsibility? Do you think that is something that can be taught or at least reinforced at an early age.
Absolutely, and I think it's a critical part of the future and the process. But I also like to point out, I don't think so much the morals of the scientists are what's called into question here. I mean, they are doing what they're being funded to – they're being asked to do by either large pharmaceutical companies or universities. I mean, a lot of this research goes on at universities that is funded by the government and private donors. So at the end of the day, I don't think the problem is the scientists and the personal level of how these scientists feel. It's more so as a government and a society – are we going to allow either the government or private companies to pursue this research? And especially big pharmaceutical companies. I mean, they will propose these research the best way possible. This is going to help so many people, and this is going to save so many people's lives. And what has to really be done is I think we have to very thoroughly examine every inch that is given to each company and each set of research.
I think my question in response to that, and I agree with you totally, is what role, though, does the scientist him or herself hold? Do they feel, do they hold themselves morally accountable for consequences? Lots of times if we're in a position and we're expected to do something, if it's strongly against where we stand, we'll say no. We're not going to do it. And that, you know, I don't mean to imply at all that these scientists are immoral at all. You know, so that's not the implication there at all. But I'm just, you know, I just wanted your response to that.
Yeah, so I think when it comes down to the moral responsibility of the scientist as far as what their work is used for or how their work is extended into application, I think, again, it comes down to a more general issue with just scientific progress, which is that sometimes and a lot of times historically, some of the inventions that have been the most harmful have been invented without knowing first the intention of what it would be used for. And now not in all cases. And, of course, a lot of this is sort of the inner workings of the government and their work on a more – on a smaller level with, like, the scientists that they are funding or the groups that they're funding to do research. But I do think that it's sort of just once an invention is out there, it's not always the scientist's intention when they create it that it will be used for whatever it's going to be used for.
And they can't control that.
And I think a big part of this is what has to be done is the government's responsibility and our responsibility to promote this as a society is that the government-funded research needs to be the research doing the cutting-edge stuff. The companies need to come second. We need to be exploring the edges as a government and at universities responsibly before we allow companies to do this.
Of course, our government doesn't believe in science.
Well, I mean, that's
– I'm messing with you, Jackson. Yes. You ought to know that by now. Okay. Gosh, we got so many more things. Let me just – address a couple more, and then if you have some issues, I mean, we haven't talked about President Trump, but that's just – it's ongoing.
So much to talk about.
It's so much.
So
it's ongoing. Eighth graders talking about charter schools at a charter school in San Antonio, Texas, Great Hearts Monte Vista School, were asked to weigh the positives and the negatives of slavery for an assignment in American history. What do you think? Was this assignment – first of all, was this assignment appropriate?
No.
Why?
Do I need to explain?
Yes. Obviously, you do because, hey,
yeah,
this is
that's
happening.
True. I guess I don't think that the assignment was appropriate because the implications of slavery and the way that the fundamental ideals that caused it in the first place are still very alive in the United States right now. I don't think that a school, even if they were trying to make an objective evaluation by comparing both the positive and negatives, I don't think that there should have been an assignment asking the students to look in and try to find the positive in something that as a society we have mostly just sort of condemned and regretted as part of our history.
Well, I think what was wrong here was the age that it was done. Is that eighth graders? That's way too young. Now, I think the assignment could be appropriate in an IB program with high-level students at the senior year or the junior year. I think it's very important to promote and not to promote that it was a positive or anyway, but I think this assignment would need to be geared towards why was it used and, mm-hmm. and for the students to understand why did it happen. Mm-hmm. Is that's the roots of it. And I think what's most important to promoting a proper understanding and to properly condemn it is to not only show a one-sided view. We're going to ask, why did this happen? And what were the positives that the white slave owners saw and that Europeans saw to this system? What did they see in it? And I think that's important. I think the age it was done was inappropriate, but I don't have a problem with the assignment in and of itself.
Do you think the assignment challenges the reality that slavery was dehumanizing? Was it dehumanizing? Maybe you all don't think it was dehumanizing.
Yes, I do. Okay, slavery was dehumanizing. I mean, slavery is okay, whatsoever. And I think that the study of slavery and the study of any controversial event, and I think this one is most notable because of its, like I said, its stake in history and in current social affairs. I think that just academically, you do have to analyze these situations from all of the potential beneficiaries and losers at the time. And I think that definitely is important. I think a wholesome evaluation of it is important. But I don't necessarily think that it's okay just as a situation to weigh the positives versus the negatives. I think that looking at the economic effects on the American South or the political effects and the way that it carried through with the Civil War and Reconstruction, things like that. I think if you really just analyze it in that way in a more academic sense, and I don't agree with Jackson necessarily that the age of eighth grade was too young. I think that the issue of it being done in eighth grade is that the class that most eighth graders are in that will be studying slavery would be like a general U.S. history course, and those courses will not go into the detail that is needed to provide a wholesome, objective analysis of an issue like slavery. I think that it's not necessarily just like the maturity of the students, but just the depth of the course that an eighth grader would be in. And so I think if there was an eighth grade class that went into enough detail about slavery and gave the students enough information, then yes, I think it would be okay to have this sort of discussion with an eighth grader. But just in general, I think the level of study that they would be doing would not suffice.
Well, I disagree. I think that the mental capacity of most eighth graders and the maturity level that they are almost universally at – along with the progression in their lives with their parents. I mean, this is for an eighth grader and for a child, this is something that's a big deal to a parent, and that's where a lot of the uproar is coming from. So I think it's very much the age. I don't think it's necessary, because I think in any study of slavery that this wholesome view needs to be taken. It should never be taught too simplistic.
Okay.
I think in an eighth grade U.S. history class, it's covered to a degree where this is an appropriate analysis, but I don't think they are at the moral or mental capacity to be making this analysis, or because they could be so easily confused. I mean, they could see the benefits, and this eighth grader could be confused and cause issues at home and other such things, and that's what we want to avoid.
And a lot also has to do with the delivery of it, the teacher themselves.
Yes,
that's
very
something
precarious.
Yes. And this is something that was in the paper today that I wanted to hear you address, and it was like on April 20th, a 19-year-old was shot and killed in Greensboro, North Carolina. His body was covered with paintball splats. Okay, he was found next to a car, and this car was covered in paintball splats. A spokesman for the Greensboro Police Department reminded us that just because it's paintball instead of guns does not mean it's safe, okay? And across the country, I mean, for example, in Milwaukee, police have responded to 65 reports of people being hit with paintballs. Another incident involved a man with his caregiver, and he was hit in the head with a drive-by paintball. Paintballs can travel up to 300 feet per second, okay? And various police departments are receiving calls about paintball. Bottom line, paintball attacks are assaults to people. When people are the target, that's an assault. When it's property is the target, that's vandalism. Are we encouraging violence? And just to give you a little history about paintball, I think it came from or it stemmed from a rapper in Atlanta, at least that's what they're saying, 12 Savage, who called for
21 Savage.
Or 20, yeah, 21. I reversed it. Yeah, 21. Who called for people to put down guns, okay, and pick up paintball.
Well, I mean, I think this is, as far as paintball, I mean, of course, I think using paintballs against someone who is not wanting to participate in this and on such a scale as was in Greensboro,
it's a big scale.
Is very inappropriate, and I think the police are dealing with it appropriately and responding. I mean, I don't have much of a comment to say on this. I mean, it's inappropriate when used in that manner recreationally. I've gone paintballing quite a few times, and it's quite enjoyable, so... And I don't think it's a promotion of violence. I don't.
That's my main question. Yeah. Do you think, are we encouraging violence? Just because it's paintball does not mean it's safe. And that's only, I'm not advocating to quit or, you know, close it. Just what's your position?
I don't think it is a promotion of violence. And I don't think you could find statistics that find it creates an increase in violence. I don't think that statistic's there. And I don't think that it causes that.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that it is related to, you know, sort of encouraging violence or endorsing it in any way. I think that it is related to a lot of other complaints that come down to recreation, like paintball, that could be considered, you know, dangerous or like encouraging violent behavior. A lot of people have this issue with video games. And I don't think that the games or the activities themselves encourage violence. And I think it comes down to other factors like the environment in which it's used. Mm-hmm. Like the situation in Greensboro, it can very easily go wrong. And that's why recreation that does have the potential to endorse violence, and paintball is a much more tangible thing than something like video games.
Yeah,
it definitely needs to be filtered by possibly a parent or, I mean, responsible adults, but...
Okay, all right. And we're just about out of time, but what's your assessment on the presidency? I'll just put it that way. I mean...
Well, I'll be honest, is something he's done has worked.
Okay.
And that's a bold statement to make,
mm-hmm.
but
the
nuclear response and so we had to North Korea, and I'll say it, and I said it on the previous recording, I was right. Is what Kim Jong-un was trying to do with his nuclear missiles was to gain leverage and to enter the global community and take his country out of the dark ages.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's getting exactly what he wants, and I think it's worked out very well. As they've signed a peace treaty. There's goodwill between North and South Korea. They went to the Olympics together. And I think the type of response Donald Trump gave was appropriate for the United States and appropriate in a type of nuclear diplomacy that we're engaging in. I mean, Kim Jong-un is a oppressive leader, and we should not give him any leeway. So when he is trying to gain leverage with his nuclear weapons, a response that you will not get that leverage is we will respond in kind and you will not come out on top is an appropriate response. And I think it's worked out very well for us.
Okay.
All right. So I'll take the different perspective. I'll look at more internal affairs and relating to the legal situation that has come up with the president. I think that the current situation regarding Stormy Daniels and the payoff.
Yes. And
I also
that
believe...
tends to plague him no matter what he said. I mean, that you can't get away from it. Mm-hmm. It keeps coming back.
It's definitely followed this pattern of legal turbulence, I think. I think that's honestly the only really way I can characterize it. And I think that like everything else, it's a scandal that will most likely subside. I think that there are some other...
You've been saying that, though. It's just gone so long.
I mean,
we said that several months ago.
I think that the more pressing legal issues right now are some of the things that... previous statements by President Trump and the differences between those and some of the things that he's been saying under oath. I think those are some of the more pressing things. And I think that the situation with Stormy Daniels is better characterized as more of a scandal. Not that it takes away from its importance at all, but just mm-hmm. that it less affects the quality of the president or his capacity to, you know, fulfill his job.
It just seems like if Trump could keep his mouth shut, that he could avoid a lot of the problems that he encounters. And I know you all got responses for it, but we are out of time. To my listening audience, thanks for your ear and your time and your comments. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.